So we are very curious to hear your lecture on Diban, new archaeological evidence. Please, Bruce.
Bonjour, je voudrais remercier professeur Romer et Nair de m'avoir invité à ce colloque. Tout le excusez, mais la langue française est trop belle pour ma mauvaise prononciation et je dois donc parler en anglais. I'm sorry. Okay. I've been asked to speak on new discoveries from Diban, where I direct archaeological excavations. This request presumes a connection between Diban and Masha, and of course, I agree. However, it is useful to briefly review the basis for this connection and any problems or uncertainties that might pertain to it, if only to define the parameters of what excavations at Diban might contribute to the study of the Masha inscription. So there's three very basic things. Tel Diban is the site of the discovery of the Masha inscription. There is very good historical and linguistic reasons to connect Arabic Diban with Hebrew Diban and Moabite Debon. And three, the Masha inscription uses the term Debon and Deboné, so it's there in the inscription. However, a number of scholars have raised questions or problems, which, while not denying the connection, make it slightly problematic. So let's think about those for a minute. First, Debon in the Masha inscription is not unambiguously a settlement or a town. It is used as a gentilic. The Debonite Yahaz is added to it, so it could be a political entity. And the other two references are to collective phrases, men of Debon and all Debon. So the common solution, sorry, I missed something. Also, in the inscription, the site of Masha's building program is a place called Karho. So the typical solution is to say that Karho is a quarter or a district within Diban. However, some people have questioned this. So, for example, Klaus Smelik and Evelina van der Steen have suggested that Diban is a tribal name, which was later connected to the town of Karho, and which is why Diban appears in the Bible as a settlement. So in this situation, then, although they still say eventually the town is called Diban, at the moment of the Masha inscription, they've argued that Diban is the tribe and not the place. Second, some people have argued that the textual world of the Masha inscription and the physical world of the Tell aren't necessarily the same thing. Most famously or infamously, Thomas Thompson argued that the Masha inscription existed entirely within the realm of royal propaganda and it had no necessary connection to historical events. We might be able to test the historicity of certain claims for building at certain sites. However, he argued that even the place names in the Masha inscription might belong to a literary tradition. So from Tom Thompson's point of view, there is a kind of warning that there's not a necessary connection between the content of the Masha inscription and the content of the excavation of Tel Diban. Less extremely, Margaret Steiner has said that we need to get past our expectations of the royal derived from the royal language of the Masha inscription and recognize Moab for what it was, an early state, which by definition would be decentralized, would be small scale, and would be primarily unified by warfare. So for Steiner, excavations at Tel Diban would be relevant to the Masha inscription, but mainly as a reality check on our reading of the royal language of the inscription. This view is sympathetic to some of the scholars who've promoted the idea of the Iron Age kingdoms of Moab being tribal states. So that would be people like Juan Tebes, Piotr Binkowski, and Evelina van der Steen. I actually don't agree with any of this so far, but these are issues that have been raised. Where I do have more problems is on the archaeological side. So if we place Masha's reign in the second half of the 9th century, and I think Professor Lemaire has has done a really wonderful job of making the argument for the potential length and placement of Meshel's reign. We're in a problematic period archaeologically. Those of you who follow the arcane world of chronological debates in biblical archaeology will know that Amiai Mazar and Israel Finkelstein rarely agree on anything, but they do agree on one thing, and that is that the end of the Iron IIa period should be moved forward in time by at least a century on the basis of radiocarbon dating. So what this means is what most archaeologists called the 9th century, anywhere up to about 10 years ago, is now probably the 8th century, or at least the early 8th century. Right? So that has impact on which relative chronological period, in archaeological terms, Meshel belongs to. Right? And so, for example, Ami Mazar and his collaborators, if I can get this to work. Have suggested that the transition, that the Iron IIa period ends in radiocarbon terms about 830 BCE, and that there's a transitional period from Iron IIa to IIb that runs from 831 to about 791 BC. As always, Israel Finkelstein is later, so Israel and his collaborator Piazzetsky would place this transition between 795 and 748 BC. So this moves it into the 8th century very clearly. In addition, if you really want to follow these things and become depressed by it, just 4 months ago, Stuart Manning's dendrochronological team has published evidence that the calibration curve for the northern hemisphere is too general, and that there is probably an offset of about 20 years for the southern Levant and for Egypt. So we're going to have to develop a regionally specific calibration curve, which is well beyond the skill set of any of the archaeologists. And then, so it'll be a while before we are able to go any further with high precision radiocarbon dating in this part of the world. Finally, Iron Age deposits are really hard to find at Tel Diban. The site has very substantial post-Iron Age occupation, a really big Byzantine town, links to Umar Rassas, and a very substantial Mamluk village in the 14th century CE. And on top of which, and this is actual, you know, this is a result, it's very interesting that where we do find the Iron Age, the Iron II period, it is founded on bedrock. In other words, they dig right down to bedrock, and so earlier Iron Age material and early Bronze Age material has been removed, and it only appears as is residual material in foundation fills. Right? Now, what we need to talk about is where in the Iron II period this happened. It's part of a large-scale rebuilding of the site. That could be Meshel, but what I'm going to show today is we really have to stretch the argument to make it fit into the end of Iron IIa, the end of the 9th century. But what is absolutely clear is by the 8th century, the site has been transformed. And so a lot of what I'm going to talk about, we might need to think of as the aftermath or impact or effect of Meshel on Moab. Right? And that's quite a bit of the evidence I'm going to point to, both at the site and around central Jordan that link to Diban really more comfortably falls in the 8th century BC. Right, so Tel Diban, by Jordanian standards, it's quite a large tell. It's 12 and a half hectares. By Mesopotamian standards, I know that's a small site, but for our part of the world, that's big. It's 70 kilometers south of Amman, adjacent to the modern town of Diban. What I'm going to do is I'm going to synthesize the results of archaeological research for more than a century as it relates to the Iron Age, focusing on either new evidence or new interpretations that can be made of old evidence. Right, so the first map of Diban, we've already seen this, Clermont-Ganneau's map. It's not a great map. He didn't actually leave Paris to make it. However, it does do two things. First of all, it highlights something that's easy to forget, which is the southern ridge of the area where the modern town is now located does have ancient remains on it. Very obviously Byzantine and Mamluk. We don't know about earlier periods. I also noticed as a result of this conference, and this is a big outcome for me, on Clermont-Ganneau's map, he marks where they say the Messian inscription came from, and it's not the Tell. If you go look at the archive version of this, it's marked on the southern ridge, not on the Tell. So I might be digging in the wrong place. We'll see. Right. Now, a much better map was made by Duncan McKenzie, famous for being Arthur Evans' assistant at Knossos, in 1910 for the Palestine Exploration Society. It's a particularly good map because he did it in one day with no surveying equipment, just pacing off distances. And it was especially good at marking the limits of the Mamluk village, which is here shaded in gray. We know that he did a good job because we ignored the map and we redid all this work and got the same results. So this is quite informative. Right, and then in the 1950s, the Acer excavations under Fred Winnett, Charles Reed, and Doug Tushingham happened from 1951 to 1953. They focused on the southeast corner of the Tell because that's where they believed the Messian inscription had been found. One member of the team, William Morton, was not happy with the lack of substantial Iron Age remains, and so he came back to Dibon and he dug for three more seasons on the summit and the side of the Tell. These excavations were never published. They're still not published. I can tell you why, because I'm supposed to publish them, and I haven't done it yet, partially because I can't make sense of his field notes. We had trouble. And as a result, we went back to Dibon to try and sort out issues from the field notes. And also the Department of Antiquities had a renewed interest in the site. So the Department of Antiquities has been working at Dibon on and off since 2002. And we've been working on and off since 2004. Okay, so some of the results, or some of the possible results as they relate to the Iron Age and specifically the Mesh inscription. So in the 1990s, Doug Tushingham published a couple articles in which he pointed out that in the southeast corner of the mound, it is entirely artificial. In other words, it looks like the site was artificially expanded by dumping a lot of soil in this part of the site. There's over 11 meters of fill that's retained by Iron Age walls in the area. If you go to visit the site, it's the area that's called the Nabataean Temple, and it extends around the corner to the north to where you can see the exposed fortification walls. So he proposed that this artificially expanded part of the site is Kar Ho, and it was built by Mesha, and this is what's reflected in the Mesha inscription. Certainly, I agree, it's a correct interpretation to see the very thin retaining walls that are embedded in the fill and the very massive battered wall that's on the outside supporting it and fortifying the site. I think it makes sense to see this as a single operation. However, there are some problems with dating this to Mesha. I'm going to try not to bore people with pottery, but there's a few slides with pottery in it and I'll get us through them fairly quickly. So for Tushingham, some key contexts for dating this fill were areas that were either under the fill or in the fill, and so particularly Bin B. From an archaeological point of view, all of these contexts are stratigraphically insecure, so they're not a good basis for dating the site. The one we could look at is the bin, because it's contained and it has some hole pots in it. So there was three hole vessels in this bin, and they're forms which could be dated to the late 8th century or into the 7th century. They have general parallels with pottery from Israel and Palestine, but the best parallels are actually from Heber el Modena on the Wadi Athemed, where there's a floor assemblage of complete pottery from House 200, and has the same jars and the same crater, but it also has this trapezoidal decanter. This is a very distinct 7th century form, which you can find in the Negev. And so this is a good chronological indicator that at least the assemblage, the parallel assemblage at Heber el Modena is from the 7th century. What we don't know is we don't know if the bin was covered by the fill or if it cut through the fill. So even then, we don't really know whether it's part of the fill, or, I mean, earlier than the fill or later than the fill. So that's all problematic. So it's clear that in the Iron Age, there was this expansion of the site, a kind of construction of a big podium. Tushigim's arguments that it definitely is Masha's work is very hard to show chronologically. Right, now William Morton excavated at several places. Area H is on the north side of the tell, and here he claims to have found a gate, a city gate, and this is the remains of the gate. What's really interesting is outside the gate, he also excavated two very large stone-lined grain silos, and these have a capacity of about 14 cubic meters each. That could hold about 11,000 kilograms of grain. So each of these, on a Mediterranean diet, you could feed 55 people for a year from the grain that could be stored in each of these grain silos. All of that, the purpose of all of that is just to emphasize that these are larger than individual household silos for storage. What's also interesting, if we go back to the site east of Diban, I already mentioned, Khibr al-Mudayna Femed, we also find grain silos outside the gateway, immediately outside the gateway. And in a similar time period, this is in an earlier phase of Khibr al-Mudayna, Michael Weigel published a fragment of a lapidary inscription that came from one of these grain silos in ZDPV in 2006. I think you were editor then, Jens. So. Right, so this is interesting because this is large-scale storage. I don't need to tell the biblical scholars in the room that the gateway is a central public space in Iron Age settlements. So this connection between large-scale storage and primary public space is really interesting from an economic point of view, and it gives us a hint or a clue about the development of whether it's a communal storage or whether it represents some kind of mercantile trade focused around the gateway. It's interesting and an emerging pattern. Okay, on the summit of the tell, in Area L, Morton excavated, and then we returned, and we also excavated beside his old excavations from 2004 to 2013. Here, Morton claimed he found Mesha's palace. He found a substantial public building that does date to the Iron II period, and so this is his claim. This is published in the Dierman volume in 1989 in the one chapter, really the only serious publication he made of his excavations. Right, so this is what it looked like in 2009. We did two things. We cleaned up the section of his excavations and drew them, and then we moved to the west and started digging to the west. All right, and we dug a lot of area to the west, and what we found was within 10 meters, there was a series of Mamluk houses built on two terraces, and so 10 meters to the west of Morton's area, the second lower terrace cut all the way through the Iron Age and went right to bedrock, and the Mamluk houses were founded on bedrock. That might seem depressing. Here's one of these great big substantial buildings. But it actually has implications for how we interpret Morton's results. And I've changed, for example, and I'll show you, I've changed my interpretation of this building, which I published already in 2004 in my book, Moab in the Iron Age. All right, so this is the section. It's a bit of a messy thing, but we were able to identify and isolate the Iron Age floors that are associated with the building. And then there's a big Nabataean foundation trench, and then a fox or something dug a big hole right in the side of the section. If we look on the south side, we can see it in more detail. And if you zoom in, what we see is there's almost 2 meters of deposit, which represents the foundation, the multiple rebuildings or renovations of the structure, and then its abandonment. And there are 3 floors, all of which fall within the Iron IIb period, so in the 8th century, the last of which is very substantial. It has an underlying subfloor of flagstones and then a big, thick plaster floor on top. So it's very, very substantial floor. In the bottom, the lowest level, where it says built up foundations, so the foundations were built by piling things in against the base of the walls rather than cutting down. Here we find earlier pottery, early Bronze Age, Iron Age 1. But we also find later pottery. Some of this pottery, and I'll show again, I won't make you memorize all these forms, but some of the pottery at the very bottom could be a transitional iron to AB. So it could be in the late 9th century, in the foundations, but there's not enough diagnostic sherds to be absolutely confident. The rest of it is all 8th century material. Now, as a result of this, these findings, I have changed the interpretation of Morton's building. So this is the very patchy remains that he found, and I reconstructed them. Now, what he did find was he claimed way out in L4WX in the last days, 2 days of the season, the last season, he dug a trial pit to see if he could find the end of the building. He found a wall, and he claimed that that was the western corner. We now know that this entire area to the west was removed in the Mamluk period, so the walls couldn't have been Iron Age. So that means it had to be smaller, and if I reconstruct it on the walls that we can actually identify as Iron Age, then we get something like this, and I'll come back to this in a minute. There was also two phases, so it was a later phase. Initially, I didn't believe that these big substantial floors, which were documented by his architect, were Iron Age. But now after we did our work, I realized, yes, they were, and they run over top of some of the earlier walls. So the renovation or the change in the 8th century, in the later part of the 8th century, was much more substantial. There's a bigger, more open room, and so the building looks something like this. Now, all of this might not seem like very much, except for one thing. Already, in 2004, I suggested there were parallels between Morton's Iron Age building and some of the more substantial public buildings we know from Israel and Palestine, at places like Lachish Palace A to C, or Omri's palace on the Citadel in Samaria. Now, I'm pleased to say that since then, this thing actually has a name. So it's now become officially recognized, but not by referencing me, but that's okay. Initially, Ilan Sharon and Annabel Zarzecki-Peleg called these buildings podium structures with lateral access. And then later, Anne Killebrew and Gunnar Lehmann labeled them Central Hall Tripartite Buildings. Both are very poetic names that roll off the tongue. I've opted to follow Killebrew and Lehmann because, as they note, not all of these structures have podiums. And a very recent example was published from Tel Ashur in Israel in ZDPV. This building is interesting because the central room is closer to being square. So it's a little bit closer to the shape of the central rooms in Diban, rather than being a long linear room. So what this is showing is it's reasonable to see this building as part of a larger Southern Levantine public building tradition from the 9th through the 8th centuries. Right, now we're going to go down the side. So we were in Field L. We're going to Field W on the far western side of the tell, right down on the edge of the wadi. And I want you to notice two things. This is what's known as a karstic depression. It's a natural hole or recess in the topography. And then there's also, this is the remains of a landslide or a collapsed slope. So we started working down here. Initially, it was our geoarchaeologist, but we found some interesting things. So running along beside the karstic depression is a very large stone wall. And for reasons I'll show you, this is almost certainly an open water reservoir. And it runs along, and then eventually it goes underground and it disappears underneath the slope collapse that I mentioned a minute ago. Okay, and we excavated this and we found an interesting sequence. There's an outer wall, which is very definitely from the Iron II period. I'll talk about that more in a minute. And then there's an inner wall, which represents a remodeling of the reservoir in which a wall was built up against the outer wall and the whole reservoir was made smaller. We know that this inner wall the renovation has to have happened after 154, 155 CE of our era, because when we took some stones out of it, we found on the bedrock a coin of Antoninus Pius, from the 18th year of Antoninus Pius. So we know that the upper wall was built after that, which is 154, 155. Okay, I'll briefly explain this. What this is showing is this is the length of what we've excavated. So far, it's 45 meters long. After 33 meters, there's a corner, and that's when the inner wall ends. So what happened is when this reconstruction was done, remodeling was done, they made it. They made the whole reservoir smaller. We don't know how big it is because we haven't gotten down to it. On the far northern end, it runs under a Byzantine terrace, and that last 10 meters was entirely covered over by fill. It was intentionally filled in, so the whole area was modified to create agricultural terraces. We think, even though the coin's Roman, that this is definitely, the pottery is definitely Byzantine, so the whole thing may have happened in the Byzantine period, which was a very big period at Diban. Okay. And when you remove parts of this inner wall, you find a very well plastered inner face to the Iron Age wall. Right? And this is showing the plaster coming off the wall and going onto the bedrock to seal the, to make it all watertight. Right? And we know that this dates to the Iron Age because we did excavations on the outside of this wall. And although the deposits were thin, we found one area where the bedrock was deeper, and there was a small retaining wall built to the west, and there was a lot of, there was in situ fill against it. This fill contains nothing but Iron II pottery, and fairly early in Iron II. Again, not to go into details about pottery, but there's the early stuff, early bronze and Iron Age, that's residual. There are parallels to Iron IIa, so these could be anywhere from the late 10th through the 9th century. There are also good parallels for what have been identified as late Iron II and Iron IIa-B transitional phases. This would be essentially the period of Mesha's reign. There are a few that are better paralleled at the beginning of the 8th century, so in particular at Tell HaSa'adiyya. And then there's some that are just generically, they could be anywhere in Iron IIa or B. All right, so here, the question obviously is this the retaining wall of the reservoir for the water in the midst of the city from line 23b, 24a in the Mesha inscription? So on one hand, I mean, it is a wall, they retained water, it's at Diban. It's a bit of a push. You could certainly make an argument that it was founded in the late 9th century, but you could also make an argument that it was founded in the early 8th century, Mesha's successors. It's not in the midst of the city, it's outside the city wall. But it is very large, and it also points to an interesting phenomena about water management, water systems, I'll come to in a minute. The only really interesting find besides pottery was this very crude stamp seal we found in this fill against the outside of the wall. It has some parallels. The best is from Abu Kharaz, that is an early Iron IIb or early 8th century deposit. All right, so water systems. I'm not going to break this down in great detail. Most people know about the shaft and tunnel systems from Israel and Palestine. These are the famous ones. These are meant to access groundwater, springs, for example. There's also quite a few that are aimed at collecting runoff or surface water. What's interesting is in Moab, we now have a number of them which are open air, but really large. It's not logical from a hydrological point of view because of evaporation and because of the sediment that would build up in them. But we have examples now from Hisban, Jalul, and Diban, all from Iron II period, and they're all much, much, much larger than the subterranean examples you find in Israel and Palestine. So that's a kind of interesting development or a distinct approach to water management. Right? This whole area, most of it was remodeled in the Byzantine period, but if you go all the way to the edge of the wadi, we think that we found the Iron Age rubbish tip, or dépotoir, is that correct? Dépotoir, a dump, right? Okay, so this is where they were throwing the garbage over the edge of the wadi. And we have stratified remains. Certainly, they go through the 8th century. We now think, although I haven't done all the work on it yet, we think we're into Iron 2A rubbish under that. So it's made of a series of pits that were subsequently also burrowed by animals. So the upper levels are very disturbed. They're not great contexts. One of the pits was filled with rocks. It's a bit better context. And then under it, all of this was cut into a much larger, continuous sort of field of garbage. Right. So there's a lot of bones, a lot of seeds, a lot of olive pits, for example, and a lot of pottery. So eventually, we're working on this right now, eventually we're going to have a picture of the kind of everyday economy of the site in a good bit of detail. But for today, probably the most interesting find is this head of a male figure. I apologized already to Regina. I do have much better photographs of this, but I had a computer problem before I left and I couldn't find them. I'm not hiding it from you, Regina. And it has a beard. It has a beard, which is the primary reason that is identified as a male. But that raises interesting issues. So let's go back to the top of the tell, to the build, I'm not going to call it Mesha's Palace, to the building, the big building, because I didn't show you the finds from up there. So in this building, there's a number, they're fragmentary, but there's a number of what you might call cultic-related artifacts that were found by Morton, also by us. These are showing the ones that were in situ and where they were located. Right, so we've got this fragment of an animal paw. What's interesting about it, if you look at it closely, is the way in which it was attached to whatever it was attached to. It allows for fenestrations above the paw. And I know this looks like a stretch, but it actually, if you were to cut off the toes of the Taanak lion, you would get something that looked similar to the paw that we found in Field L. All right, this cult stand, cylindrical cult stand, was found by Morton and then has been lost. Nobody in the Department of Antiquities knows where it is. And this is the only photo. He had no good photo of it as well. So this is a mystery, but it's a very well-known form. This head we found on top of the upper floor when we were cleaning the section. And this matches very well with, in the top row, the two heads that Nelson Glick published that he found at the Modena Themed and at Balua. These are often or debated as to whether they're male. They don't have a clear beard, but they have a pointy chin. But what I want to emphasize is if you look at the face and you look at the way in which the ears and the eyes and also the smile is depicted, whether they're male or female, they have many parallels with the facial features of the better known female figurines holding a disc, which we find many of in what we would now call Moab. So whether you decide it's male or female, there is still a stylistic or maybe even a workshop element that suggests a kind of commonality to these heads. There were female figurines with the disc found by Morton, at least the one on your right. So this, again, fits a well-known type. These have been discussed, for example, by David Tsukimoto and by Sarit Paz. Now, we found in the Mamluk context adjacent to the section, we found this very battered figurine. I credit one of my former students, Rebecca Trow, who actually identified this. I thought it was just a potsherd. And here, if you look very closely, it is the remains of one of these female figurines holding a disc. It's hard to see, but if you look at it in your own hands, you can see that. Now, what's interesting about these figurines is these female figurines with a disc. Is that they are found on both sides of the Wadi Mujib. There's examples found at Balua and in the Mashur. That's interesting because if you've ever been to Jordan, the Wadi Mujib is 7 kilometers wide and 1 kilometer deep. Even the idea that Moab spanned both sides is interesting, and it raises the question of how people circulated and interacted such that we would come up with stylistic similarities. So we can see these similarities in some other things as well. So burials. So we look at the tombs. There's a series of tombs that the Asor expedition excavated to the north of the Tell. And when we look through these tombs, you find a common set of both functional types of pots and also stylistic forms, okay? And we can, so in those, we can define a set of five types of pottery that seem to be essential for the burial rituals, and they're in a common style, suggesting there is a shared idea about what these things should look like. Right? And then if you go and look at the other excavated tombs, particularly from the 8th century around central Jordan, particularly, I mean, both south and north of the Wadi Mujib, we can find this same pattern. So I've put together the, I think it was five tombs there, and shown you how in each of them there was a common set of objects that were buried in the tombs. Part of this idea I got originally from one of your students, Professor Nair, the special session you did at ICANA years ago, but it was never published in the proceedings. I was looking for it like mad. He pointed out the larger patterns. So across Jordan, the censers in particular and the juglets are found. The difference is in central Moab, it's more specific and the styles are more distinct. So it's an even tighter grouping. All right, so this suggests then that people were moving around, interacting with each other in the context of what we call Moab, and as a result, developing common ritual practices and common stylistic elements. This is interesting, and it's a better way of thinking about these things than something abstract like ethnicity or national identity. This is actual physically, the idea of physical movement and interaction is an essential way to understand how pre-industrial groups who didn't have mass media would be able to share common ideas and common artifacts. Because some of the figurines may be from the same mold. Right, so these are this is the sites that have the burials that I've just shown you. And I'm going to make a few conclusions, and then I have a little tiny bit to say after this about the Diban today. Right, so what I, at the moment, my conclusion from all the excavations is that Diban's peak pre-Byzantine size is in the Iron Tubi in the 8th century. An interesting phenomena is that there's not very much 7th century Iron Tubi at the site, and this pattern is also repeated at Tel Madaba, which is also a really big site. Tim Harrison and Deborah Foran have said that it might be as big as the whole Tell, so 16 hectares. If you made a list of sites, this would put them amongst the largest amongst the largest 8th century sites in the southern Levant. When we look at 7th and 6th century, there's an interesting phenomena of the balance of settlement moving east. So places like Julul, Khibr al-Mudayna, Themid, which is Michel Davio's excavation, these have good 7th and 6th century context. And then if you go north, Hisban is another site. So in terms of what you call secular trend in demography, there seems to be a shift to the north and the east away from the traditional major tells in the Mashur. Okay, and then we've seen already there's a common elite architectural form employed. Yes, it's fragmentary, it's not ideal, but we can make the argument that they are sharing an idea of a public architectural form. Busera and Kalat Aman palaces, which are later, are very different. They're in the open court style that we associate with Assyrian influence in the southern Levant. There's common communal water storage practices or technology. There's common economic practices in terms of the grain, large-scale grain storage outside the gate. And there's common styles of figurines, maybe regional workshops, and then common burial ritual and funerary artifact styles. So as I suggested, we need to start thinking about how people were moving around and interacting within Moab. And as it happens, we have two sites, which may well be pilgrimage sites from spanning Iron 2A and Iron 2B. And that is WT-13, a survey site that Michel Davio found and Kerbet Atzeruz, which Cheng Hoji has been excavating. Okay, so these are the sites there with Diban marked in relation to them. Wadi Athemit is a tiny, tiny site, only about five by 5 meters. And it has a couple phases, in which the second phase, which dates to the 8th century, maybe the late 8th century, is quite spectacular. And that's where, that's where Michel found, for example, these anthropomorphic statuary and lots of figurines. Interestingly, in the earlier phase, where these objects don't exist, a study of the animal bones showed, this is in the Iron One period, a study of the animal bones showed that they weren't whole animals, they were selected cuts of meat that people had to bring out to the site, because it's out by itself in the middle of nowhere in between settlements. More standard in the sense of you could argue it's a temple, is at Kerbet Atzeruz. The stuff that you may have seen is the Iron 2A material, and that's from this the large sanctuary room, things like this bull statue. You can see it very badly displayed in the Madaba Museum. But in the second phase, this area here, I can't get my cursor to work, but to the far right, you can see the solid block that's marked as an altar. The area around that is from the Iron 2B period. I know this because the report is being published in Levant in the next issue or two, along with this limestone incense altar that is inscribed on the outside. I don't know what the inscription is because Chris Ralston hasn't told me, but it'll be published in Levant very soon. This is another site in which the ritual component, even though it's a decent sized site, the ritual component takes up most of the built architecture in the settlement, or at least it's a much bigger than the number of people who could live there. So we have a possibility in Moab of actual pilgrimage sites in which people were circulating, things like figurines and other ritual objects appear there, and this might be a candidate for how people began to develop in the aftermath of Mesha some sort of common experience of interaction and knowledge of each other on both sides of the Wadi Mujin. Okay, and the last thing I want to talk about very briefly is the fact that the site of Diban is actually really a poor site to try and isolate a single person like Mesha. The site is a palimpsest. It's occupied continuously. It was already 2,000 years old at the time that Mesha reigned, so he lived in a site that had lots of earlier stuff in it. They dug into it, they used it, and that's happened ever since. Okay, so when we look at a site like this, a story that goes at one period of time is not a good use of the site. You need to work regionally, you need to have bits and pieces everywhere. And then on a site like this, we need stories that go through time. We need to be thinking about the site as a place in which people were always living with the past. It was literally the ground under their feet, okay? And that continues to today. So just like the Mesha inscription is still in the Louvre, it's still here, it's a thing in 2018. Diban is still here, it's a town. I'm gonna make a pitch for you. Diban's a town that's had a lot of problems. It's been one of the centers for Jordan's version of the Arab Spring since 2011. In 2016, there were very large scale riots that ended up with young men up on the tail throwing Molotov cocktails down onto the riot police. In 2017, we found tear gas canisters all over the tail. Now, this has, to their credit, this has stimulated the Jordanian government to do something about the situation because of the very high unemployment rates. So they've already invested this summer real money, not notional money, which is what usually happens in Jordan. And for example, they've cleared out this late Roman Byzantine tomb that Bliss discovered in 1895 very substantially. I myself, at the end of this month, am making an application to the UK's Global Challenges Research Fund for a cultural heritage protection and sustainable development grant. What does that have to do with you? Well, There are many possible futures for sites like Diban and objects like the Mesh inscription. The oddly named Mesha Center for Studies in Human Rights in Madaba regularly protests outside the French embassy in Amman, demanding the return of the Mesha inscription. So there are confrontational futures like this that we could deal with, but there are also the possibility for collaborative futures. So, for example, the director of the Ministry of Tourism in Madaba told me this summer, I don't want the Mesha inscription to ever come back. It's the best free advertising we could possibly have. So what all I want to stress is trying to bring into the same frame the Mesha inscription now, the people in Diban now, and this rich history of it. And if anyone is interested in this kind of work, there's lots of possibilities because of the suicide mission my current country is on in terms of Brexit. There's continental European funding possibilities that would be very interesting. If a certain world-famous museum wished to donate a high-quality replica of the Mesha inscription, I can personally make sure that it's on display in the new visitor center that the Ministry of Tourism is proposing, and we'll have a nice plaque crediting that museum for its generosity. And finally, just again to emphasize this point of connectivity between the past and the present, 2 years ago we were having our storeroom in Madaba painted, and everyone was teasing me and saying, ask the painter his name, ask the painter his name. So I did. I said, Salam Habibi Shwismak. And he replied, Salam Doctor, Ismi Mesha El Dibani. All right, thank you.